Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? March, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out. He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
The main reason I came to this area is because no building restrictions whatsoever. That's really hard to find in this country. There's just no building restrictions out here, in South Brewster County, which is pretty miraculous, actually, because the population is really tiny out here. It's cheap to live out here as well. I started with a 40-acre tract. It was $8,000. And the 20-acre tract I bought south of me was $500. I came out here to get away from debt. I was deep in debt, and the mortgage on the house I had was pretty steep. I was going to become a statistic if I wasn't careful, and luckily I was able to sell the place and walk away with a chunk of change to go somewhere and start simple. Yeah, I got this doghouse for my chickens, hoping they'd start going in there, and they're sort of spending some time in there, but they sleep all night right on my porch in front of my door. Hey, chickens.
So, is this your house?
This is my house. All 128 square feet of it. When I first moved out here almost 7 years ago, I was a set builder in New York City for a number of years, and I used those skills to build the basic box of my house in a week and put it together and moved in. And that took 3 months to do all the finish work with the second roof and the metal siding and the interior. One of the tricky things out here is shade, of course. I did this sort of double roof thing on my house. Now, there's actually an insulated waterproof cover on the top of my box of a building that I live in, and then I've got a foot above that is this other metal roof that adds shade. Air can pass through there and help suck any heat off of it. And it really makes a big difference as far as not cooking yourself in the summertime out here. So this is my outdoor shower. It had a door on it, but it blew off in the last storm. We get some pretty heavy winds out here, and my door blows off usually twice a season, and I haven't rebuilt it yet. So, which out here, it doesn't really matter if you have a door or not.
And how does it work?
Well, there's a tank on top. There's an insulated box on top, and there's glass on the south side and on the top of it, insulated glass. And it's just an old steel tank from a hot water heater. And I manually fill it. I climb the ladder here and fill it because I don't use that much water out of here. This panel on the side here is a thermal siphon, which basically helps heat it up faster in the wintertime. it's disconnected right now, so it's not really doing anything. But when the sun's lower in the winter and it beats down on this panel here, this gets really hot, and it naturally cycles the water without any pumps or anything, hotter and hotter inside the tank. In the summertime, you never take a shower at the end of the day because the water's way too hot. You wait till the first thing in the morning. Of course, out here, when you live by yourself, you don't have to shower that often, because if there's no one to smell you, do you, you know, really stink? When I first moved out here, the cheapest deal on solar panels, you know, there was 45 watts of solar. Three of these panels was one set. That was about $4.50 a watt. Now, solar you can get for under $1 a watt. These run my lights and my swamp cooler. It's such a tiny house, I have a fan running 24 hours a day in the house just to circulate air through there. I left my house in upstate New York when I moved out here. That house was 2,800 square feet. So I've gone from 2,800 to 128. My house in upstate New York, it was a big farmhouse built in 1845. There was an upstairs bathroom and a downstairs bathroom. There were four bedrooms upstairs. And I used 10% of the house most of the time. I had to buy all this furniture just to put stuff in each of these rooms that I never went into. And so you're in the foyer and the kitchen right now. Then we have a long hallway, and there's a bedroom on the right and an office, living room, dining room on the left.
Wow.
And, you know, it's funny. I lived in Manhattan for maybe 12 years, and I never had an apartment anywhere this small when I lived in Manhattan. I always had, I think the smallest was 350 square feet, so this is 128 square feet. Of course, in Manhattan, this would probably cost you $1,000 a month in rent for something this size. I cook down here. There's a propane tank under the counter, and it's just a, you know, a regular burner thing. Turn it on, you have to light it with a match. And I have a solar oven I use occasionally as well, but simple stuff like soups and pasta and stuff I just cook in here on this little propane grill top. Everything's so simple here. You know, I was busting my ass 7 days a week just to pay all the bills for all the stuff I had. And now it's pared down to one room. I've got a huge yard, you know, with all this land. I can't see another house from my property, which is another big plus. There's very little stress out here. The only time I get stressed out here is when there's a big storm, because storms are scary out here in the desert. Just, you know.
What do you do for refrigeration?
I've got a chest freezer that's regular 110 volt AC. I run it off my solar stuff. I just use it as a refrigerator. As long as you keep it packed full of stuff, it doesn't take much to keep it cold.
Yeah.
We got our cheese in here. With a chest style, you open the lid, all the cold doesn't come pouring out. So I just turn it on for maybe an hour a day and then turn it off, and then it keeps everything cold. I can even make ice if I turn it on for 4 hours and pack some stuff in the bottom. It'll ice it up. So it works.
Yeah.
Works good enough.
Yeah.
It's funny. I built these cabinets originally and didn't have doors on them. And then I started chucking all my stuff into them, and I thought, I don't want to look at all that stuff. So I spent like a week making all these doors and sealing everything up. And it's just OSB stuff, board-oriented strand board. It's like plywood, basically. It's cheap plywood. This is my favorite one right here. This is my ammo cabinet. Being in New York City, I was never much of a gun person, of course, but when I came out here, you know, a 911 call is maybe 45 minutes before somebody calls you back to make sure there's an emergency, and then another 45 before they get here. So I have 8 guns now and a bunch of bullets and stuff. But everything, it's all OSB.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there's insulation in the walls and in the ceiling. This has held up pretty good inside. You know, this is almost 7 years old that I've been in here. So when I moved out here, I knew I could get my phone line brought out to me, but I wasn't sure about the DSL, and I was close enough to still get that as well. So I have a landline and DSL. You know, people will correspond with me and say, it sure looks lonely out there. Is that a lonely place? And I say, well, places aren't lonely. Only people are lonely. It's funny, when I was a little kid, I used to think that when I grew up, I was going to be a hermit. And then I moved to upstate New York, buy this giant house because I think that's part of the American dream, and then discover it's going to kill me to try to pay for this. There's no way I can afford it. So I sell that, and I come out here and start from scratch with this space. And it's kind of like I think I'm fulfilling that prophecy of the hermit thing, except it's not like the traditional sense of being a hermit. It's more living in the world and not being of the world. And I think a lot of people choose to live in a smaller space like this, to live not beyond your means. This is the timer circuit for my swamp cooler. It pumps water through the swamp cooler every like 4 or 5 minutes. And that's what keeps it cooler in here. It's coming in right through this window here. There's 4 fans blowing right in through here. Yeah, that was the lifesaver the first summer I discovered it gets really hot in the desert. I researched swamp coolers a little bit, and I found some 12-volt options that were over $500, and I thought, I could build one for probably $100. And I think mine cost about $85, the first one I built. There's a little bilge pump in here, and I fill this with water. And the bilge pump is hooked up to a timer, so every couple of minutes it turns on and pumps water up into this little reservoir here, which drips it through this evaporative pad here, and then the excess comes back down and back into the bucket. I have to fill this up twice a day on a really hot day when it's running all day long. It's a swamp cooler, they call them. They're also known as evaporative coolers. Now, they only work in areas with really low humidity. If it's more than 25% humidity, these don't work at all.
So, and so you just got a couple coolers?
I got a couple of coolers. I knew basically how a swamp cooler worked. You have to have fans that suck air through a pad of some kind. Now, when the water drips through from the top, it sort of soaks this pad. And this is actually a cardboard pad. It's really thick. It's about 4 inches thick. This gets soaked with water, and as the air is getting pulled through it, the air evaporates some of that water as it's passing over it, and that's where you get the cooling effect, where it cools down. It's 101 right now in the shade. The most I've ever seen is a 25 degree difference between the ambient air temperature and what the evaporation is doing to the air. You know, I could actually put a small window unit air conditioner in here and run it off some solar. You know, my solar stuff is pretty minimal. There's people out here that have huge systems that, you know, cost them $10,000 to put in, and they can live just about the way anybody lives. You know, they can have a toaster oven and a curling iron and a microwave and a freezer and a refrigerator and all that stuff. And, you know, I don't really need all that stuff. Well, you know, the reason for the phone is when they ran my phone line out to me, they actually made this driveway for me and placed the box for the phone right behind it here. And somebody almost ran this over a couple of times before the greenhouse was here and anything else. And I thought, well, I should block this with something. And I figured, well, a phone booth would be the perfect thing. So. This building, which was part of my grand scheme when I came out here, was to create this giant greenhouse courtyard thing with shipping containers. I spent 4.5 years building this by myself. I'm trying to get 2 containers ready to be cleaned out and insulated and closed off, and I'm going to move into one of them eventually and have another one as an office and workshop space. This one was going to be my house, and then this, I was thinking this would be like an office and a workshop, but now I'm almost thinking that I don't really need an office and a workshop because I've got all this area out here, so I'm not sure what. I am thinking of putting an indoor shower in. One thing I discovered I was a much better builder than I was a farmer. Basically, I've created a restaurant in the middle of the desert, so any bug that knows about it is going to come in here and start eating plants. This is an orange tree right here. This is a fig. That's the grapefruit, and then there's another fig. This is a pomegranate here. No pomegranates this year. The idea is to try to grow as much food as I can in here, but I've discovered in the 2 years I've been sort of playing with some plants, I need to climate control an area of this more than just some fans and stuff. You know, I've got these shade screens here to shade out a lot of the sun. It's just too bloody hot. I think in this framed area here, I'm going to section off with some plastic and actually put either an air conditioner and or a swamp cooler on it. And that can run off solar. Just have a small zone that's protected and cooled. That way I can get a few more things to eat.
So these cutouts on the shipping containers, I made, there's going to be a big glass door here eventually, and the same on this one. Actually, cutting was really easy. It actually took me maybe 5 minutes to cut that out. I used a cutting wheel on a grinder. One thing I discovered sort of once I got started and got all these containers, I call it the 10 reasons not to use shipping containers. And the main reason is this whole thing has become so popular now that the prices of these is just skyrocketed. You know, if you have a big truck and a trailer and you can drive to a port city, you can pick up a 40-footer for probably $800. But if you buy it through a broker, it's going to cost us $5,000-$6,000 to get it delivered to you. So these cost $3,400 each, including delivery. You know, for that amount of money, I could build a structure the size of four of these, as substantial as these are. And you're starting with a metal box. You got to do a lot of work to it to make it livable, because it's a friggin' oven in the summertime, and it's an ice box in the wintertime. And you really got to insulate it good and shade it. And of course, mine are all sort of attached to each other because of this roof system and the way they're, you know, built into the foundation of the project here. Nice thing about them is they don't blow away. They're pretty heavy. If you could really just get these for $500 a piece, it would be worth it. You know, I've got all the house projects in line now. I've got shipping container houses to do. I've got a big trailer to do a mobile house on maybe someday. It's really a feed trailer for now, but, you know, I've got an Airstream to redo. My Airstream here was kind of an impulse buy a couple of years ago. I'd been kind of looking for one. I had an Avion in upstate New York, and I left it there when I sold the house, but that's where I sort of started my off-grid experiment in renting my house out to what we called cityites, you know, New York City people who wanted a weekend place for the summer. So this is actually just a closet. Throw extra stuff out of the way. I've got a bed in here. I throw a bunch of extra clothes in here.
And so it's your guest bedroom.
Kind of, yeah. This one came up for a reasonable price. It's been gutted inside. And eventually, I hope to redo the interior of this.
Do you think you reach a point where you no longer want to be tinkering with things?
No, I just need a break. Just like, I got to take a break. I haven't been away from here in 3 years, other than, you know, like a day trip. If I stay here much longer, I'll never leave here ever again. The thought of traffic and lots of people just doesn't appeal to me at all anymore. And I joked over Christmas, I went up to Odessa Midland area to run some errands. I hadn't seen a stoplight in I don't know how long, and it was Christmas time, and I thought at first they were just Christmas decorations because they, you know, blank red and green and stuff, so... You know, the closest stoplight to me is 160 miles away. Where my house is basically the very center of a 40-acre tract, which is a quarter mile square. The southern border of my property is just this little ridge right here, and there's a road off to my right to the west here that you can't really see from here. The other direction, it's hard to say exactly where my border is over there, but quarter mile square. I've got 100 acres total, and I pay $300 a year in property taxes. What I pay per year here is what it costs me about every 8 days to live in upstate New York. I was paying $1,000 a month in property taxes alone, and this is all bought and paid for, you know, cash. I pay property taxes once a year. I dance into the property tax office every year to pay my bill because it's so low. The only rule that I know of out here is if you have a permanent residence on 10 acres or less, you have to have a county-approved septic or a county-approved composting toilet.
Where's your toilet?
The desert is my toilet. I have a composting toilet. There's just a box here that's got a bucket in it with sawdust in it, and then you take the bucket with the sawdust and dump it into it. I have a couple of bins where I just keep that stuff to compost. Yeah, you know, if you have a big city and everyone's just going out in their front yard and pooping, it could be a problem eventually. You know, out here, the idea of a toilet, a flush toilet, just makes no sense whatsoever, unless you've really got some gray water you can use to flush stuff down with. I know people out here that don't have enough rainwater catchment set up. They have to haul water just so they can flush their toilet. That's just crazy. These are some of my extra water tanks up here. The ones attached to my greenhouse, and I've got a little one on my house, these capture all the rain off the roof systems,
which is a little cleaner. It's not running through a creek or anything like that. And my greenhouse roof actually gives me 1,500 gallons per inch of rain. I've yet to fill up all my tanks in a season because rain's been kind of spotty. Ideally, I only need about 8 or 9 inches of rain a year to fill everything up. Now, these tanks, there's a little creek that runs right behind here when it rains really hard out here. So I use a gas pump, and I pump out of this creek into these tanks. And this is just extra standby water. It fills up, and it looks a little muddy, but it all fills out, and it's clear looking. These are 3,000-gallon tanks. This one's about half full, and this one's full to the top. This is 1,500 gallons. This water is probably 3 years old in here. You can never have too much water catchment storage. I've got, my capacity is 21,000 gallons. Right now I have about 11,000 gallons on tap, and it's only rained 2 inches in the past 6 months. The bicycle washer, my bike-powered washing machine. So this was a little project that I'd thought about a lot when I first came out here. I gotta make a bike-powered washing machine. So I finally did. I used it a couple times, but these top-loading style use too much water. You know, a front loader uses a lot less because it just tumbles through. And I think the belt, yeah, the belts even come off of it. So the challenge was getting the drive to work right with the gear underneath. Because the belt underneath is, you know, this direction and this one's this direction. I had to twist it and... Oh yeah, it's agitating. Oh, here goes the belt.
You make it?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'd been thinking about it for a long time, and finally somebody had a washing machine they were getting rid of, and somebody had a bike. So I put the two together. And when I first posted some pictures of this and talked about it, people, did you invent that? And, you know, people have made bike-powered washing machines for years. And, you know, it's hard to invent anything anymore these days. Someone's already thought of it.
This is what I cooked most of my stuff with for the first couple of years. This would heat up to about 325 in here, but this big piece of glass that went on here, I finally broke. People are always asking me how you maintain the temperature in a solar oven. I bought one of these little dials, the oven dial, and this just goes on the thing here. So that's how you control the temperature in a solar oven right there. I started a new solar oven that's supposed to give me about 450, and I've got huge reflectors that go on top. Basically the same idea, you just have it pointed at the sun, but this has a lot more surface area reflecting more sun into it.
Hey, chickens. Come here, Mr. Chicken. These girls are just about grown up enough to go free ranging. Well, there's two roosters and two hens.
And you just built this out of sow materials or something?
Yeah, this was, you know, pallets from the building supply place they give away. These sheets of metal that are on top here to protect them are cutouts I made off the shipping containers.
When you come out here to live off-grid, you really got to know what you're doing, because if you don't, you're going to discover, like so many people have who've come out here to try this. They come out and discover, you know, unless you're really prepared and you've got some money and you're willing to do the work yourself, you know, you're going to discover it really sucks out here. Before I sealed up my house, or the porch here, before I sealed everything up, I thought I'd run some piping through this slab, through where the slab was going to go, under the house and then into the house, and then I have vents at the top of my house with some little fans in it, so as they're sucking air off the ceiling, which is hotter, it would be drawing air in underneath the house through this little tiny zone that's got to be cooler because it's in the shade and it's under the house. And it turned out to do nothing as far as climate control, and all it really did was have a place where dust could get sucked into the house. So I called it my micro geothermal air conditioning experiment that didn't work because it was just too micro.
I don't know if the population's ever going to really grow out here, because, you know, people kind of like to have something to, you know, a place to plug in and then a place to turn on a faucet. That just doesn't happen out here.
No, actually, I have an elevator that goes down to an Olympic-sized swimming pool that's buried underground. So I'm not going to show you that.
Can you do that?
Got to be willing to do it yourself, which is perfect for me because that was my plan from the start.
Hi everybody, I'm Jonathan Fields and this is Good Life Project. So my guest today is Josh Kaufman and this is a special episode. One of the things that we've discovered through a lot of our viewers is that the process of trying to live a good life, a better life, often requires you learning a new set of skills. We've had a ton of questions over the last year from people who say, I would love to do this, but I don't have time in my life to do it. I don't want to wait forever to make it happen. So we're bringing you Josh, who's also the author of a book called The First 20 Hours, who's an expert in, I guess, what I would call accelerated learning. So great to be hanging out with you today.
Thanks for having me. Great to hang out.
Couldn't sort of like have asked for a better person to drop in at a better time, because it really is. It's an interesting thing. It seems like the world is moving faster.
Mm-hmm.
We all want to get stuff done. A lot of people want to make big changes and feel like they're living better lives, but they look out there and they're like, there's stuff that I need to know, stuff I need to learn, stuff I need to master to do it. And I just don't have time in the day to
do
it.
Right.
So I'm curious. I mean, I want to get like right in with you, sort of like the idea behind your book.
Sure.
But one quick question first, which is, what was the motivation for you to actually go down this rabbit hole?
Yeah. So two primary motivations. The first is, you know, in terms of the research and the writing that I do, I like to look at topics that are like fundamental human experiences, like things that everybody needs to know or everybody deals with in some way, shape, or form. And those things can be, you know, big and complex and scary and frustrating in a lot of ways. But if you just dive in and break it down, what you often find is it's not really as hard as it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the motivation was, you know, learning is something, you know, learning new skills is a fundamental part of what it is to be human. Mm-hmm. And so let's figure out how to do that. Let's figure out how to do it better.
And most people, like, for most people, the thought of learning new stuff, I'm giddy. I love it. But for a lot of people,
it's terrifying.
Right.
Particularly if it's something you know would be super fun or super valuable, but you know nothing about it, and you just look at it like, oh my gosh, this is really big. The motivation for me personally was, I run my own business. My wife Kelsey runs her own business. And 2.5 years ago, our daughter, Leela, came into the world. And all of a sudden, we had zero free time. And I really geek out about this stuff. I have a list of things that I want to learn a mile long. And so, you know, not having any time, it's like, okay, I may only be able to set aside, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes a day.
Yes.
So if that's all I have, then, you know, let's figure out how to learn as quickly as possible in that short period.
And at the same time, you don't want to wait forever to get results. I mean,
that's
a lot of people are like, okay, I could figure out, like, I could scrap somehow to find, like, that half an hour a day. But does doing it so little mean that it's going to take me, like, 10 years to actually be decent enough at it so it'll actually be fun?
Right. And what I found through my research is that totally not the case. It doesn't take very long.
Yeah.
Even if you know absolutely nothing, or you only have a certain amount of time every day to sit down and learn it, you can become very, very good at something in a very short period of time.
Mm.
I think that's fun.
So, but this flies in the face to a certain extent also in what like has commonly become known as the 10,000-hour rule.
Sure. A little bit. It's actually a lot more complimentary than it would seem at the surface. So the whole idea of the 10,000-hour rule came from research by Kay Anders Erickson, Florida State University. And the idea behind that was, you know, if you look at the people in ultra-competitive, easily ranked fields, professional golfers, musicians, all of these folks where you can get an estimate of who really is the best in the world on an objective level.
Right.
The question that Dr. Erickson was researching is, what does it take to get to that level
right,
on
like
some
top,
very
top,
narrow
top
thing? Yeah. So if you want to step on a golf course and compete with Tiger Woods, that's about the amount of time it's going to take you to get there. But the vast majority of us, that's not the goal. That's not what we're trying to do. There, we just may have something in our minds that we want to accomplish, or an area of life we want to explore. And it takes a lot less time to get what we want out of something.
And I guess for a lot of people, the motivation is probably one of two things. You want to get good enough so you enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
Or maybe like professionally, you want to develop a skill set enough so that you can actually start to leverage it to build your career or change your career for a lot of people.
Yeah. There are a bunch of things that you can learn that can help you, do better in your business. There are a bunch of things that you can do to do for fun. It doesn't take that long.
Yeah. So let's dive right into it, because you kind of have a methodology.
Yes.
That you've developed. So take us through the, I guess it's five sort of like core ideas.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So the first step in this process, and this is something that applies to every skill. Could be a motor skill, like learning how to fly an airplane or skateboard or something like that. Could be a cognitive skill, like language or programming or something. So the first step is deciding exactly what it is you want, right? Why are you jazzed about this thing in the first place? If you're able to really clearly define what it is you're trying to get, it's called setting a target performance level. The more clearly that level of performance, the more clearly you can define that, the easier it is for you to look out into the world and find ways to get there in the most direct way possible. Right?
So like, what's an example of that?
So for example, for me, I learned a lot of things in the process of putting together this book. And one of the things that I wanted to be able to do was program. And so instead of just saying, I want to be a programmer, right? Doesn't give you any information whatsoever.
So amorphous.
Here is this idea of a program that I would like to sit down and create from nothing. And it looks like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. When I make this thing, I'll have developed the skills that are necessary in order to get the particular result, right?
Got it.
So instead of learning everything in the world about programming, I decided this is the subsegment of that skill I'm interested in learning first, so that's what I'm going to focus on first.
So it has to be like very goal-oriented and also very specific.
Yes. So what is it going to look like when you're done? What are you going to be able to see or experience that'll let you know you reached the level?
Okay, so like if you want to learn a language, I want to speak French enough, or is it
not enough?
So like,
yeah,
what would that look like in your sort of like framework?
So let's say, for example, I want to go to a restaurant that has a French-speaking waiter, and I want to order and conduct the entire meal in this language. And have a good time doing it. That's something that's specific enough to practice.
Got it. Okay.
So you make it too specific at the beginning, because once you get to that level, you can always ratchet up the stakes, right? You reach that threshold, practice something else.
I mean, what I found is once you get the most baseline proficiency in something, it sucks less.
Yes.
And now you actually like that baseline level. It creates a whole new level of motivation to want to learn more, because now you've kind of gotten through like the scales in music or something like that.
Yeah, and it's important to understand that the first couple hours of practicing something new are frustrating.
Yeah.
For everyone. Everybody's terrible at the beginning. And so, if you can push through those early few hours, the practice itself becomes fun and it becomes way easier to continue to improve.
So, okay, so that's number one.
Yep.
Number two.
Okay, so after you decide what you want, you do what's called deconstructing the skill. And the idea behind that is a lot of the things that we think of as skills, like, for example, playing golf or speaking French or learning how to program, those aren't exactly skills. They're really kind of general topics that contain lots of smaller sub-skills.
Right.
So it's really hard to practice being a good golfer. It's way easier to practice hitting off of the tee with a driver. Right. So you take the global skill and you break it up into much smaller parts. And if you're clear about what you want, it becomes very easy to find what are those sub-skills, what are the smaller parts that are actually going to help you get to that target performance level as quickly as possible.
So like if there are 100 sub-skills, if you've done number one, it makes it much easier to figure out, okay, what are the 15 of those sub-skills that are going to give me 80% of the results towards getting where I want to go.
And what you often find is it's only maybe two or three sub-skills that you use most of the time.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's just, breaking it down into small enough chunks, if you do just a little bit of research, which is actually step three, right? You go out into the world and you find sources of information
right.
that help you do this deconstruction. If you look at, you know, say for example, pick up 5 books on whatever it is that you're trying to learn how to do.
Mm.
Don't read them cover to cover. Skim all of them, one right after the other.
Right.
And what you'll see is the 2 or 3 sub-skills that you're going to use most of the time are the ones that come up over and over again. Right? So you just practice those first. And if you spend your time practicing those things and avoid a lot of the distractions or things that aren't going to help you, you save a lot of time and energy
okay.
as you're practicing.
So that's a big question, so I'll ask you now. If out of a whole basket of potential sub-skills that add up to this thing that you want to accomplish, only a small handful are very often really, really critical, why are we taught to do them all at once?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that, actually. I think the biggest thing is we treat, in our culture now, learning as a very academic exercise.
Mm.
Like the objective is to suck in a ton of information about
right.
this thing, whether or not you're going to use it. And I think, you know, education in our culture now has been seen in the academic sense and less in the sense of practicing something with the eye of using it to do some particular cool
yeah.
thing.
So it's less applied.
Yeah.
More
yeah. So, theory. You know, the whole idea of researching the topic and something that I had to train myself out of is I love doing research, right? So the first thing, like programming was a good example of this for me. It's like, I want to learn how to program. I get 10 books, and I have these courses,
right.
and I'm going to go through all of this stuff, and then I'm going to sit down and write a program.
Hmm.
It's like, no. You use the research, do just enough research to help you do the deconstruction and find the most important sub-skills first,
hmm.
and then get out of research mode and into practice mode as quickly
right.
as you can.
Because that's where the real stuff's going to happen.
Yeah.
yeah.
And when you start practicing what it is you're actually trying to do, that's when you
right.
see the performance improvement.
Now, you also made a differentiation when we started the conversation between cognitive skills, like learning a language,
yes.
and
motor skills.
Yep. Motor skills, you know, like swinging a bat
mm-hmm.
or, you know, playing golf. Do all of these steps, I mean, we still have 2 more to work through, but you know, with the 3 that we covered so far, are they all sort of equally relevant to both types of
yes.
learning?
Yeah, so for both types of learning, you have to go through the same general process. Some of the actual practice techniques can be different. So for example, one of the things that you can do when you're practicing a motor skill, which works really well, is practice it within a couple hours of going to sleep. Either
huh.
taking a nap or going to bed for the night. And there's a lot of research around the idea of what's called consolidation. So your
right.
brain translates the practice and experience you had and encodes neural connections to help you do it better.
Right.
That practice or that process is way more efficient if you practice within about 4 hours of going to sleep.
Hmm.
So I, in the process of writing the first 20 hours, I retaught myself how to touch type on a different keyboard,
hmm.
which is like, you know, having the experience of rewiring my brain to do something differently.
Right.
And then, you know, fun things like playing the ukulele, which is all motor skills. And it's surreal experience. I would practice it right before I would go to bed. And, you know, the first couple hours of practice was just terrible.
Right.
So I would practice, I'd go to bed, I'd pick it up first thing in the morning just to see. And it was like astounding how much better I was after a couple hours sleep.
That's amazing.
Because, you know, sleep helps consolidate that kind of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, no, that's really cool.
So yeah, some of the actual practice techniques are different, but the same, the general process is the same.
Right. So that's pretty remarkable. You literally wake up in the morning and you're better than you were when you went to sleep
yeah.
just because you slept in the middle of it.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so for...
Like noticeably better? Like really?
Noticeably better. Like, you know, one of the... In the process of learning typing, like, you know, once I switched keyboard formats, I went from typing about as fast as I could think to literally, like, 5 words per minute. Like, terrible.
Right.
And so, you know, practicing right before bed and getting up in the morning and trying to use my computer, like, in the first couple of days I was doing it, it was like, oh my gosh, I can actually type now. I can do something.
That's crazy.
And yeah. So you know, that type of thing works for a motor skill. For cognitive skills, memorization techniques like spaced repetition and reinforcement, like flashcard model or flashcards with feedback helping you remember things works really well. So yeah, the actual practice techniques can be very different, but the core method of learning is very much the same.
And again, for both of them, before you go to bed,
yes,
helps with the consolidation.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. What about simulated practice?
Simulated practice can be effective as long as it is as close to real world performance as you can make it.
Right.
So you know, a lot of the trying to memorize something and then having that translate directly into practice doesn't really work.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more in terms of like motor skills.
Okay.
Yeah, like when I was a gymnast when I was a kid, we would before any event, I would basically, before I would step up to a piece of apparatus, I would kind of close my eyes and I would actually envision my body like moving through the entire thing.
Okay.
And then there was all this research that said that, it triggers all the same motor neurons that would be triggered, like the same response in your brain.
Yes.
As if you were actually doing it. But I'm curious in terms of sort of like, accelerated learning, whether that would actually make you progress faster and towards a high level of proficiency in that skill.
Yeah. There is quite a bit of research that says that imaginary types of practice does work, and it works well, with a catch, which is you have to do it in addition to
the real
physical practice.
Right.
Right. So if you're starting to consolidate those motor movements and you're doing that in practice, and then you're reinforcing that with imagined practice, awesome.
Got it.
But what I found is a lot of people get caught up in the process of just doing the physical practice first.
So we got to three of the five steps now. Mm-hmm. So let's kind of like close the loop here. So step number four.
Okay. Step number four is removing barriers to practice. So things that are preventing you from actually sitting down and doing the work.
Okay.
Sometimes those things are environmental distractions, like turning off the TV or blocking the internet or closing the door. All of the things that you can do to make sure in those early hours of practice, which are frustrating, you don't get so frustrated that it's easy to stop focusing on whatever it is that you're doing and start paying attention to something else. Likewise, anything that you can do to make sure it takes as little energy as possible to start practicing is super helpful at that point. So, instead of keeping your guitar in the case in the back of the closet on the other side of your house,
right?
Take the guitar out of the case, get a stand, put it right next to your next to your couch. And that just, anything that you can do to make it easier on yourself to get those early hours of practice, the better.
Yeah, I mean, my guitar is actually hanging out on a rack because of that. It's like, almost because I just forget it's even there.
Totally.
It's like the visual cue actually makes a really big difference for me. Yeah. All right, so number four is, now, I'm curious also, it sounds like there's a bit of crossover between that and sort of like B.J. Fogg's work on
really tiny habits.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, a lot of the same, this is where the behavioral psychology elements of this come in.
Right.
It's how can you make it easier to do the thing that you want to be doing instead of getting distracted by some shiny object and going and doing something else. So instead of relying on exerting a lot of willpower to force yourself to do this thing that you've decided you want to do, you spend a little bit of willpower, a little bit of time and energy altering the structure of the environment around you.
Right.
And just make it easy as possible to do the thing that you want to do.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, last item, number
last
five.
Last one. Pre-commit to practicing at least 20 hours. And this is the big one. So all the things that we've talked about so far is getting set up to sit down and do the work of actually practicing. The pre-commitment and the idea of practicing at least 20 hours, there's a lot of behavioral psychology behind that. The two big things is, first, it's a really important check on your reasons for learning this thing in the first place.
So it's kind of like, if I'm not willing to commit to 20 hours, I can't be all that serious about it.
Yeah, it's like, is it worthwhile for me to rearrange my schedule and stop doing other things? And, is this something that I'm expecting to get enough benefit from to make the effort worth it?
Yeah.
If it's not, don't do it.
Right.
Life is short, It's like, go do something else that you will get more benefit out of or you are more excited about. So if you're willing to set aside at least 20 hours, what the pre-commitment does is make sure that you practice long enough to push through that early frustration and actually start seeing results. And I think a lot of us really seriously overestimate just how long it takes to become good at something. Mm. So you can become really, really good at something, surprisingly good at something, in as little as 20 hours.
Mm.
So if you practice that long, you're going to be way better at the end of that than you were at the beginning.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people also figure, well,
20 hours, you know, I've done that with a million different things, and you know, I really wasn't very good. But probably when they actually look back and say, well, no, like I missed 3 days here, and like that one day where I, you know, said I was practicing for an hour, I was really only practicing for 10 minutes. So when you really add up all the time, I'm guessing there's a little bit of self-delusion that happens.
There's actually quite a bit of research behind this. Our minds are not built to accurately estimate time. And in the early parts of learning something new, it's like, you know, it's terrible. It's like, oh man, I've been at this hours. And you look at the clock and you've been at it 10 minutes.
Right.
And so a lot of the, you know, both pre-committing to a certain amount of practicing. So 20 hours roughly is about 40 minutes a day for a month,
okay,
give or take.
So you kind of think in your mind 40 minutes a day for a month.
So a couple of, and I usually break my practice sessions into about 20 minutes a piece, right? So 2 20-minute practice sessions every day for about a month
cool.
can get you there. And so, you know, if you're able and willing to do that, pre-committing the time, make sure that you practice long enough to see that really good result. But it's also, you know, psychologically not, it doesn't feel like that big of a hurdle to say, okay, this is important to me.
Right.
I can set aside at least that amount of time, right? So it's just enough that you're going to see dramatic results, but not so much that it prevents you from making the pre-commitment in
right.
the first place.
I love that. So let's recap the 5 steps.
Okay. So the 5 steps in order. Step 1, decide what you want. What's your target performance level?
Mm.
Step 2 is deconstruct the skill. Separate it into smaller sub-skills. Practice the most important ones first. Number 3 is research the skill just enough to do the deconstruction and choose the most important sub-skills, but not so much that it becomes a barrier to practice
mm-hmm.
in itself. Number 4 is eliminate barriers to practice. Make it easy to do what you want to do. And number 5 is pre-commit to practicing whatever it is that you want to be able to do for at least 20 hours.
Mm. Love it. All right. So my mind is spinning because I'm thinking to myself, okay, what am I going to do?
I was going to ask, what's in the back of your mind? Have you always wanted to learn how to do?
It's interesting. I mean, languages, because I don't speak another language.
Mm-hmm.
I took Latin for 6 years, which means I speak nothing but English. It's interesting. Like, I want to blurt out a whole bunch of different things, but number 5 is making me say, I need to really think about this.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to, like, say, okay, people, I'm going to commit to this publicly.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, an hour after we film this, I'm like, I'm not really, like, willing to put in my 20 hours for that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. I'm really thinking that through. Awesome conversation. And I love sort of, like, the breakdown that you have. And this is all part of, this is all, I mean, obviously...
Yeah.
Detailed and, you know, a whole bunch more extensively in the first 20 hours. But thanks for stopping by and sharing this with me, because like I said, one of the consistent questions that we keep getting from people is, you know, I know that for me to get to a place where I feel like, you know, like I'm living well in the world, I'm doing these things, career, personal, whatever it is, there's a body of knowledge that I need to know and get decent at. But I don't know how to do it, and I think it's going to take forever. So I think this is a really great formula to help people get there.
Thanks. And, you know, I think the really good news is that the outcome of this research is the barrier to sitting down and learning something new is not intellectual.
Mm.
We're all smart enough to sit down and figure it out and practice in a
right.
smart way. The barrier is emotional. And so, you know, a lot of these things are just working with ourselves in a smart way to decide we're interested in doing something, figure out how to do it, and actually sit down and
nice.
Practice so we can do a bunch of cool stuff.
Love it.
That's fun.
Awesome.
All right.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My guest today has been Josh Kaufman, the author of The First 20 Hours. I'm Jonathan Fields, signing off for Good Life Project.
All right, today's podcast is titled The 15 to 20 minute tiny house. The 15 to 20 minute tiny house. Our goal in reaching the goal before the end of the year is essentially in our mission statement, teaching people how to build their own off-grid housing using social capital. So there are 2 books that we're going to fundamentally use One book is titled The First 20 Minutes, which you can go to Amazon and Kindle and download that book to your favorite device. And the other book is, by the way, there are videos on that book and audios on that book, The First 20 Minutes. One Red Paperclip. One Red Paperclip, the long and short of that book is a guy started with one red paperclip and kept on trading it up for various items until he got a house. And, you know, there are videos on YouTube for that as well. But the first 20 minutes, so first 20 miles. So the primary goal is to, within 20 hours, and let's say you have absolutely no construction experience, no house building experience at all, within 20 hours, you learn enough to self-correct. All right. Now, in building up to those first 20, and that applies to anything. How many times when we were learning how to walk? Well, matter of fact, let's take the Olympians, the world's fastest human on the planet, whoever that might be at the moment, because that changes from Olympics to Olympics every 4 years. But the fastest human on Earth, right now in 2023, when they were born, just like you, me, and anybody who's coming to this Earth realm of existence, they couldn't walk. They went from not knowing how to walk to learning how to pull up their bodies to finally, and we don't know how many times it took them, you know, to get how to figure out how to pull up their body just to sit up, then how to pull up their body to stand up and stand up for more than a few seconds, to taking the first step and falling. How many times, and I wonder if anybody's done a study on that, how many times did a person on average fall down and stand up, and in between that hit their head, bust their lip? But no matter what happened, even when the crying, they were crying some kind of way during the crying, during the pain, during the humiliation, they were still working on how to stand up and then walk. The world's fastest humans, as in the Olympics and other sporting events like that, we all start out the same. You don't know how to walk. So we have to keep at it, learn how to run. So whether it's 20 hours, we don't know. But in 20 hours of falling up, I mean standing up, falling down, busting our lip, hitting our head, falling down the stairs, falling out of bed, and all this other stuff, we learn in those first 20 hours to become the Olympic sprinter or whatever, okay, or the mother running behind those kids, because you got to be fast for that too when they're little, is you learn, no matter what the topic is or subject is, you learn enough to self-correct. So that's dealing with learn how to walk, learn how to cook. You know, your best chefs around the world didn't come out of the womb knowing how to make a crepe Suzette. Okay. You know, my first meal, what grade was it? It was the summer between first grade, and I hadn't started second grade yet officially. I remember my aunt taught me how to cook a hot dog, which here's a pot, fill it up with water, here's the hot dog, put it in there, turn it on, you know, turn on, you know. For me, man, that was a big deal. I learned how to cook something independently, and it turned out all right. All right. And then you just move on from there. So what we're doing, starting on either Monday or Sunday, we do Sunday, it'll be an evening session. If not, if we miss that session, then we'll just come here at the regular time Monday. But what we're going to do as of the start of next week, which is Sunday, is for those who want to, people that want to join us, we develop the habit of building something, particularly dealing with a tiny house, taking at least 15 to 20 minutes out of a day, and hopefully we can do this together. 15 to 20. Then now we can do more than 15 minutes, but bare minimum, we want to get in the habit of taking 15 to 20 minutes out of a day to do something towards building a tiny house. It could be organizing materials. It could be, I mean, and we'll break down the different parts of this, you know, how we want to do it. But at least 15 to 20 minutes. Now, we could spend 12 to 15 hours a day building, but the main thing is, bare minimum, pick a time where every day, either in the a.m. or the p.m. If you miss the a.m., you can catch us on the p.m. Every day, we take at least 15 to 20 minutes to build something or add on to what we're already building. Like on Monday, we, you know, the 15, 20 minutes might be, we might be able to build a door. Or then Tuesday, we might be able to, within 15 to 20 minutes, depending if we have help or by ourselves or some kind of help, within 15 to 20 minutes, you know, if we're working on a 64 square foot, 100 square foot, 144 square foot, or even a 300 square foot floor, okay, you know, we're able to, with that, that's what we're able to accomplish within that 15 to 20 minutes. And then, you know, until, like I said, within that 20 hours, hopefully we will have completed the tiny house within that 20-hour, the first 20 hours, by knocking off 15 to 20-minute intervals on a consistent daily basis. And that, see, the more we do this, the better we'll get better at it. We can do things quicker than, you know, within 15 to 20 minutes. You know, we should be able to pump out a tiny house. Now, if that seems improbable, let me throw this at you. Toyota, and I'll do a full podcast on how Toyota started, Toyota cars. Toyota cranks out 29.9 cars per minute. On average, a Toyota car and or truck, depending on the model, has about 30,000 parts. The tiny houses that we'll be building will have nowhere near 1,000 parts, let alone 30,000 parts. All right. Ford, GM, Chrysler, those guys, you can look this stuff up online. You know, I don't know what, 19,000 parts. They make about anywhere from 12 cars per minute, 19 cars per minute, somewhere like, you know, in that range. But Toyota does 29.9 cars per minute. McDonald's makes like 75 hamburgers per minute. You know, two pieces of bread, a hamburger patty, what, two or three pickles, ketchup, mustard. Oh, listen, because that's part of the first 20 minutes. You know, we had to dissect what we're going to do. All right, so let's dissect a burger, which a McDonald's burger, which they crank out 75 a minute. Now, this is globally, this is not at one particular location. So let's dissect the parts of a hamburger. We're not even going to go sophisticated with a cheeseburger. All right, but a hamburger at McDonald's or at your home. All right, you've got two buns. You've got some onions on there, grated up. You got the ketchup and the mustard condiments. Let's see. Put three pickles on there, so we're up. I think that's it. I think that's it for a basic burger at McDonald's. And that's we can deconstruct it to eight parts. You know what? I'm going to get somebody on here that worked at McDonald's. He can break that down even too. We'll get him in here next week. All right. So that's eight parts, and be able to do that in more sophisticated versions of it with the cheeseburger or the double cheeseburger or the Big Mac. Which has more parts to it, but 75 per minute. All right, so we're going to go from the book. And here's the thing, because once we've accomplished that and know how we can self-correct and do it faster, now we've done over 2,000 of these podcasts over the last 9 years or so. We had a guest on last week. She was talking about one of her mentors that has 4,000 properties, of which she's got 250 ads to sell properties. Now, can you imagine you receiving 250 paychecks in a month? It's possible. Many people are doing it. Matter of fact, this is why I like the Chinese carryout menu. Next time, if you got a menu in your house from a Chinese food restaurant or any restaurant, but China, that's what I got to run here. And just go through each and every item on that menu and count how many items they have. Because each one of those items represents a paycheck. So on the menu I have around my house, it's anywhere from 200 to 300, probably closer to 300 items on that menu that people come in and, you know, somebody might want to order a soda. Another person might want to order egg roll. Another person might want to order shrimp fried rice. Another person might want to order vegetable fried rice. Lunch specials. The one that I typically frequently order from once or twice a month, they have lunch specials, and that menu alone has 30 different items on it. Translation to them, 30 different paychecks. All right. So, and, you know, that's only during certain parts of the day, Monday through Friday. They also have, you know, dinner platters and, like I said, it's over at least 300. So, but we want to keep it simple so you can get into the habit. You know, if you do it consistently for at least 21 days, at least that's my magic number for me, 21 days in a row, I've developed a new habit. So, like I said, we'll either Sunday evening, or if we don't start Sunday evening, it'll be Monday morning during the time that we do this. And we're going to take 15 to 20 minutes, all right, and start building something. Like I said, it'll be something simple, and then we'll just keep on adding to it, and then, you know, we'll look back. You know what? I could have done this faster if I'd done it this way. So, and the whole goal is to, you want to build, and then, you know, the more we build, the more we can sell, the more we can make money. And this is, we're talking about you on an individual basis. So, that's the deal on that. Okay, let's see. Area code 773, your mic is open.
Hi there. Gemma. That's on Elijah with me. Yeah, Grand Rising. So, I would think that White Castles, those small burgers, I used to work at White Castles. So to your point about the how many burgers you can get off the grill, I suppose.
Well,
and,
let's talk about that. What job did you have at White Castles?
I did work the register, and I was on the grill. And, you know, I would say those hot onions, those orders that hit the hot onions, one coworker, she said, hey, you move fast, the onions won't burn, because those onions actually burn. It makes you go faster because you're working with hot food. So you're stacking the top of the buns, then the meat on the grill, and it's, the method is like you're sorting cards in a way. Yeah, so it's really,
okay.
It was fun for me, yeah. So I would say that
White Castle. How many burgers could you, now White Castle, that's the place that has those little burgers, right? You get a whole bunch of them in the bag.
Yeah, so you're making more,
Right. I used to, those.
Yeah, McDonald's has more
so
franchises.
How many of those little burgers could you make in a, first thing, how long did it take to prepare the burger?
If I could recall, probably 60, I don't want to just guess, let's just hypothetically say it took 45 seconds to make the burger. The grill is already hot. I don't want to give away their secret. I don't know if it's a secret, but you toss the...
No, there's so many burger joints out here.
You throw those grilled onions, you throw the onions on there if they want onions to grill them.
Uh-huh.
So they're on the side, really. So I would say 45 seconds, maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
I would have to
all
go
right.
back. How many? How
well,
many can
that,
you make
I mean,
in a minute?
That sounds reasonable because
when people
come into a fast food joint, people are hungry and they don't want to wait 15 minutes. They don't want to wait 10 minutes to get their meal.
Right, but we had the rush
So
the rush,
yeah, right.
I know they had me on the grill and I was doing it.
Right.
I could say I could make, you can make 20 in a minute.
You can make
20 in a minute because we had the crave cases too. So with the rush, and then with White Castle, you could have at least a couple of grills going. But I remember certainly producing because that grill is already hot. It only takes, when you're sorting, so let's say it takes 30 seconds for them to heat up, you know, from frozen to done. You just toss in those onions on the burger. If they want a special sauce, we have this ketchup mustard mix. It was delicious. So, yeah, depending on the specialty, but those, I was able to keep up with the demand. I was certainly, let me see, I could look that up. That's something somebody probably did ask before. Let's see. That is interesting.
Well,
how many White Castles are made in a minute?
Right, and so the assembly line technique. So essentially, we you know, it all starts with, you know, they train you. So the same psychology can be applied to anything, actually. So, I mean, McDonald's, I mean, I went to Wendy's the other day, first time in a long time. You know, I ordered two. I mean, I was specific with my, you know, order. And I say I waited no more than 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah, but that as far as the assembly line technique with White Castle, that I was, we bagged our own. We bagged our own.
Okay.
The cashier handles the orders. So the mess is so fast that we are able to bag our own, the grillers. We may get help from time to time to bag. And, of course, I was, you know, bagging at one point. And, of course, you're stacking those boxes in the bag. They fit perfectly in the bag. If there's like four on the bottom or two on the bottom and so forth. Yeah, so their method is so tight because you're making smaller burgers, and an order could be, you know, as far as one burger, you know, that's going to go in with the next person's order, as far as on the grill. It's going to go. That's just a specialty burger. But you make them and you make them special. I do recall bagging my own burgers too. So it wasn't quite assembly line, except my from the grill to the bag to handing them to the cashier, who puts the napkins and the special sauces in the bag. Or if I added special sauce too, because they started coming out with the packets of special sauce years later after I was working there. They had the special sauce. I forgot what they called the sauce, but it was a mix of ketchup and mustard, but I bagged my own burgers from the grill. And I remember stacking them on the side. I'm trying to look it up. But that was really a fun job, to be honest with you. That was, you know, if I could have just gotten up and gotten out the house. They have the just like McDonald's, the share, you know, where you, the shares, you can buy shares in the company and so forth. So, good, great place to work.
I'm looking up,
and I work for Burger King. Burger King was good, too.
Okay.
Now, that's like McDonald's with the assembly line.
White Castle sees record single day sales.
How many burgers can be made at White Castle's in a minute?
Right. Let me see. How many burgers? I'm looking at for another fast food place.
Well, they actually have it online. They have the method online. It said, okay, how White Castle sliders are made from spreading the onions, because the burgers go right on top of the onions. While the onions are cooking, that helps the burgers to cook. Grilling the onions, spreading the onions, grilling, layering the bun, packing station. So that's where they will pack them specially. But,
this is a whole video. I'm looking here at McDonald's. It says, how many burgers does McDonald's make in an hour? This is roughly 4,500 burgers are made per minute. So
how many?
That's way above the original. 4,500 burgers are made per minute.
Okay.
At McDonald's. 270,000 per hour.
Mm.
Which is 6,480,000 per day. Jesus. And over two billion 360 million burgers per year. But like I said, it all starts with on Netflix. I don't know if it's still on there, but it's definitely on Amazon. The founder starting Michael Keaton. But the McDonald's brothers, because they weren't the first ones that, I mean, they did not invent the hamburger, okay? Nor, I mean, who's listening to this podcast right now, be it on demand or live, can make a better burger than McDonald's. And there's a lot of burger joints out here. You get Wendy's, In-N-Out's. My favorite is right now is Five Guys. From, you know, ones I've tasted. But,
yes, that is one of the
course,
best.
If you like chili, though, it's a place in D.C. And probably in Chicago, they got a lot of little eating places that serve good food, too. But people, they have a system down. So what I want to do with, what we shall do is, I'm going to say it, start off simple. 15 to 20 minutes, but the key is we have to do it every day. So we'll agree on a time in the a.m. You know, we can take something out of, you know, our little live podcast time and do it, 15, 20 minutes, or something, you know, in the p.m. hours, just 15 to 20. Now, we can spend a lot more than that. We can spend 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 hours, whatever we want to. But bare minimum, we do something 5 days a week to fit together when it comes to building a tiny house, 15 to 20 minutes, the bare minimum. Because those insignificant, you know, what might seem insignificant steps build up day to day to day because you're developing, you know, a new habit, so to speak, which you can convert into money. I mean, once again, McDonald's is a sign, but the system is they, you know, they, and it's teamwork, really. You know, I mean,
but one thing about White Castle Burger, they have holes in them.
Payroll or teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, they do.
They have holes in them.
And that makes
what?
The burger cook
it
quicker.
There you go. Yep. So I still haven't found how many can be made in a minute.
All right. Well, we know it's a lot.
Certainly, because I've made a whole case.
Let's see.
So once that video, I guess it'll probably at the end of that video, I may tell us. Let me see. I didn't play the video.
Okay, hold on. How many White Castle? All right, how many White Castles in the United States? All right, in the United States, there are 377 White Castles as of
2019.
370? Okay. 377 with locations across 13 states in the United States. Okay, they're 101 years old. They have 2019, they have 377 locations. All right, that's quite a few. And they took in 2019, $720 million, actually over that. So they're cranking out, 377 locations, they're cranking out burgers. They're cranking out burgers. So, like I said, the same thing we can do just, 15, whatever you got to spare for that particular project, 15. And Chris, we're coming to you in a moment. 15 to 20 minutes a day.
It says that White Castle was the first fast food chain to sell 1 billion burgers. 2 years before McDonald's cleared the same benchmark.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that. Well, White Castle's got some good burgers. Okay.
Perfect.
You know, like say they serve them.
Those
quick.
Onions make them.
They're hot.
Yeah.
And their sliders. Matter of fact, before that term was even used, that's the product that they had. And I remember you get a bag of them, and if you're hungry, and like I say, it doesn't take that long. You know, so Reba, you got some experience with that. So we want to do the same thing. And, you know, we can with the right manpower. The right manpower and the right system.
Mm-hmm.
Because when a person goes into White Castle or whatever to order that burger, you know, it's a team there. There's somebody that takes your order. That's a team member. There's somebody mm-hmm. behind that grill like Reba. That's part of it. Then I'm sure they had people that helped prepare the stuff and, you know, so you can do what you can do. And then, you know, the place has got to be Club King. So, as a matter of fact, on a shift, Reba, that you when you were working at White Castle, about how many team members were on duty per shift?
3 to 4.
Okay.
Yeah, 3. One on a window, one on a register, and one on the grill. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So,
I'm trying to remember where I stacked the boxes because there could be the packing station.
Uh-huh.
I just remember packing some of my burgers, my bags at times, yeah. Yep.
Right.
They were like, you can do it. I remember it was the teamwork. Talk about coaching. I'm going to screenshot you this picture, too, to let you see how the grill looks. It's really interesting.
Okay.
Really, yeah.
Well, we're going to take your life experience and transfer that into, you know, imagine now, you know, there are people that we just had one here a couple of months ago, or a month and a half ago, Pastor Slade out of El Cajon, California. You know, Pastor, man, I need a place to stay. Pastor, I'm about to get evicted, and I don't know what to do. And imagine if we have a system where it's like 3 minutes after 12 noon where I'm at right now on the East Coast, you know, lunch. Imagine somebody comes into somebody's church or, well, it was a church or some religious nonprofit, whatever, and within an hour, we have assembled for them a place to stay. If Toyota can make 29.9 cars per minute out of 30,000 parts, I'm sure we can do this. But let's like to just break it down, deconstruct the parts, and 15 to 20 minutes a day, and that's how we get to where we have to get to. Okay, and we have a builder that we hear on Reba's side, one of her grandchildren. They're going to be one of our future builders. Okay, 309 area code, your mic is open. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, hold on, Chris. 602, area code, your mic is open.
Hey, good morning, L.A. I've been on the radio show. I'm sorry I had a couple calls, but I am here supporting. Shout out to Chris Collins, everybody who's supporting this broadcast. Y'all doing something special. Y'all changing the future. So I am here, sir. Good morning.
Good morning, glad to hear you. And tell us, because you're on all the time, tell us how we can listen to your live stream podcast.
Well, we have over 10,000 shows, but the best way to listen to my podcast is to call me direct. So I'm going to tell you the pertinent podcast of the moment. It's 602-478-1619, 602-478-1619. With that being said, L.A., man, bro, keep doing your thing, bro. I support. I'm texting people and telling everybody about it. Keep doing your thing.
Matter of fact, when we organize the system.
602-478-1619. Once again, 602-478-1619. I do apologize. Let's get it.
No problem. We're going to put Reva's White Castle method together and apply for house.
I'm listening to White Castle. I'm a White Castle beast. I remember, and I'm sorry, I got to go back in my bag, but I remember being on Shandor and Jefferson in St. Louis going to that White Castles every day. I ate White Castles. I should be a White Castle. That's how much I was into. So, come on now. I love White Castles.
When I was in Detroit, I used to go to White Castle. Twice a week.
Man, White Castle is the best. And if you got $3, they can serve your order. $3. They can serve you. Come on now.
there was a place in Baltimore, Beasley knows about, I don't know if Beasley's listening, called Tyrone's Chicken. Man, for $2, they gave you a meal. There was enough for two people to
for
eat.
$2?
Just for $2. $2.
Oh, my God. Wow. That's big.
Yeah. But anyway, but Reva, we're going to take that in the White Castle tiny house stuff. 309, Chris Collins, your mic is open.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Ms. Chris.
I like the White Castle part of it. And yes, they have holes in them to not only cook the meat faster, but to continue to steam the onions if need be.
Mm.
So I didn't work at White Castle, but I know the construction of how that burger is done. Because I watched it on Modern Marvels. So there's, you know, now if you look at the White Castles that they put in the grocery stores that you can buy, they don't have pickles on them.
Okay.
That's the difference between the ones you get fresh and the ones that you get in the microwavable ones.
Right.
Okay.
Because I can't give you good microwave pickles.
Right. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people probably didn't notice that. Yeah.
Now let me ask this, Cam. When you go to White Castle, because like if I, it's rare that I go to McDonald's, and if I order a Big Mac, I without pickles, could you go to White Castle and say, this or that or the other, without pickles, could you special order that way there, too?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, honestly,
okay. All right.
If they don't want onions, we still would lay out the burgers on the grill, but we would just remove the onions because the onions is what cooks the burger. That's part of the secret.
It's the best part
that's
of the burger.
The onions, the juice.
Come on, man.
Juice
that's
and the onions. Pardon me?
That's the best part of the burger.
I said I love the best part for me too, but
okay.
Me too, but I like what Reba said. The onions help cook the burger though.
The juice.
They put quite a lot of juice in there. And of course as you put onions on the grill, you gotta have, you know, enough juice from the onions, and we call it juice. Water, whatever. And so, that top bun is actually placed. How do we do that? But the top bun. I think we flipped it. The top bun is actually placed on there while it's cooking, I believe.
Okay.
And then you scoop it with the spatula, and then you flip it some kind of way, and you place the bottom bun on there. As far as with cheese and things like that, like, so that'll be, you just slide them over to the side. I guess maybe that's why they call it slide. Slide them over to the side, like maybe to the right. And then you throw that cheese in there before you put that bottom bun on there. Yep. So then you have the bun, the burger, then the cheese, and then that bottom bun. That makes it fast, too, to even make it a cheeseburger.
Man, I'm a White Castle Bees, and I'm in Mesa, Arizona right now, but I used to go to White Castle in Shenandoah, Jefferson, in St. Louis, Missouri. I was in that Bees 5,000 times. Police came, locked me up, all that. I know White Castle. White Castle's good.
They want you up in there. They was like, look, you act like you live in there, huh?
Yes, ma'am. I had my laptop, everything. No lie. White
What's
Castle
your name again?
Oh, Pastor Don G and CEO.
Pastor Don G, CEO?
No, Don Jr. CEO. Pastor Don Jr. CEO. I'm an avid supporter of L.A. and all his platforms. I text out a lot of people. I tell everybody, come in this radio show. It's my house radio. It's time to show y'all what real radio is. And this is real radio.
No, I updated the name of the show. It's no longer It's My House. It's DIY Housing TV.
Okay.
Which stands
for. Okay.
Yeah, it's less than two months old, the name change. Yeah, but DIY Housing TV. But under the archives, it's still It's My House.
Amen. But, hey, L.A. been doing it for a long time. He's a good brother. I support him. I support what he do. And one thing I can say, if he bring in a topic about White Castles, you better call in and listen because it's deep.
That's true. We breaking it down, right?
Right. I'm just like, wow. Y'all talking about White Castles. I'm like, okay. I called in the first one. I'm a White Castle
dude. Yeah, the first 20 minutes, I said, if we want to do tiny houses, okay. It's all right, you know. It's all we have to deconstruct it, you know. Look at the parts and a great example because everybody can relate to a burger. You know, it doesn't have 30,000 parts or whatever, and it's simple. So, but it's very commercially viable. So with a tiny house, all right, we're not dealing 30,000 parts on there. You know, essentially it's a box, and we're dealing with small boxes. So, you know, we deconstructed, you know, what are the parts of the floor? What are the parts of the wall? I mean, walls. What are the parts to the, you know, the roof, you know, the windows and all that. So we just take it one item at a time. And like say, we, you know, if we get together just for 15 to 20 minutes out of your day, not an hour, but now we can spend more time than that. But I'm just saying. If we get into the habit of, all right, well, oh, we see some improvement from yesterday. Oh, wait a minute. And then by the end of the week, we see market improvement within 3 to 5 days. You know, then particularly when you start cranking money out of this stuff, then, more and more people. Just like I say, some people might be facing foreclosure, eviction, or whatever, and you know, they might need a solution by the time. I mean, the kids get out of school at 3 o'clock or 3:30, whatever, and they need a roof over their head. Like for instance, there might be a family that is at risk of losing their children to CPS or whatever you call it in your neck of the woods. Okay, so if they could go to pastor, imam, rabbi, Rebus, somebody, and you have a system in place where you can set up a legal home, I mean house that they can live in before 5 o'clock today or 3:30 today, within the next hour or two. All right. That's a niche market that I'm sure you'll have plenty of people that that'll need a place to stay. You know, it's warm now. But, you know, before you know it, late September will be here. And in the northern states, like, you know, in Illinois, Chicago, Milwaukee, and all those places, you're going to hear the cool snap at night, you know. So, and let's say you don't, the shelters are closed, you can't make, but if there's a place where you can go and participate and learn how to build your own house, I think that's a niche. You know, everybody's not going to beat down the doors to get on with it. That's okay.
That's a
it's a niche.
Amen.
It's a niche. Right. So I like the fact that Reba brought up the White Castle thing, because we can fundamentally, and Chris is a builder, so, you know, we can, you know, just take ideas from one and apply it to another and, you know, go from there. So,
yeah,
Chris, any comments?
I had a phone call. Yeah, I've got a few comments. Just for one, I want to get some of y'all's suggestions, either that or I'm going to send you a Zoom link after this show, because at noon, there's a big influencer that just called me. His name is Grant Cardone. Well, one of his associates called me. But I've actually, you know, had many conversations with Grant. But they asked me, what is it that we are having a problem with? That's what they asked me. And now they want to jump in a Zoom after the radio show today. And I told him it was mainly informing people. Now, we also have someone that's, you know, they got millions of followers and all this. So, it, you know, there were some influencers that were sitting here. But the point is what is it that we need that we can ask? Now, I put it down. I asked them to sponsor 1 to 100 of those tiny packages that we want to deliver. Now, these people are billionaires.
Okay.
So I was like, I'm looking at them like, all right, look here. You know, pop out $100,000, buy the 100 packages, let me deliver them, and then let us spark this and let's see. Because they were asking me, what's it worth for the sales? Because I told them sales. We need people to buy. And they said, well, what is it worth for you to have them? And I said, well, why don't you tell me? I said, and I'm either going to tell you yes or no, and I'm going to tell you to go. I said, you want me to tell you how much I'll give you? I want to know how much you'll take. So at noon, there's going to be a serious conversation, very short. It won't be a long Zoom meeting. But I want to put it back in their hands, and I want to say, what are you going to do? Show me. But we also
now,
need to come down and figure out what is it worth.
What time's on, Chris? Because it's 9:19.
It doesn't matter. It's going to be a half hour after 11:30. So at noon my time, 1 o'clock yours.
Okay, all right, okay. That's doable. That's definitely doable.
Awesome.
Anything else?
Let's see. Yes, we put some packages together. It's just the framework where you have to build them. And we have a 16-footer. We have a 20-footer. We even have a 10-footer. You can turn these into businesses as well. Okay, that you don't have to live in them. They can be an income-generating situation. And I've got a new product that is a lightweight concrete that has an R50 insulation rating, and the finish on it is beautiful, and it can have many different options. But with the marriage of the two materials, our material marries perfect to it, 100% with no problems, no oxidations or anything like that, and the guy's willing to move the factory anywhere we need to set it up. And he's got one he's going to load up right now. They're putting it on the semis. So he's in Oregon, and
I'm extremely interested in what's about to happen off of what has been happening. I've been having some amazing phone calls every day, and I had one yesterday at 4 o'clock that that kind of changes things, because now we have someone that has a building product that is certified across the planet. And I did a wall similar to his design, not to his patent. I just built a wall and had it tested with a man that's not here anymore. And I'm trying to see if I can't get all the information from when we did it. But I built a wall that was 2x6 deep, and I put this finish on it. And when that wall was built and done, we shot a 2x4 out of the Texas A&M, shot a 2x4 at it out of a cannon and disintegrated it. Well, that's basically what this man has as a patent product, and they can make it and ship it and everything. They've got all their semis and everything, but he can take our material and put it inside of that material, and that way all the outside corners and everything can just screw together as they stand these walls up. But there's kind of a nice marriage to that product yesterday, and I want to, at some point, we'll get more educated to it, get him on here and talk about it. But he is the licensee person for this product, and they have an extremely good one. And to get an R50 insulation rating, I want people to understand, you're building a refrigerator box. You can either heat it or cool it.
Okay.
I got an R50, the house I built in 2011. That means the attic is the same temperature as the house. It does not transfer heat and cold throughout the walls and ceiling. I had to cut holes in the walls to bring air into this house because it was so tight. It was raining inside of it. It was condensating before there was any interior walls and no floor. Pea gravel in there, and I had the roof on it and had it all sealed up. And it was sweating. So if you walk in and you see wet spots, see things raining inside a building, that's what that building was doing.
Okay. Let's see, I'm looking at a picture of a White Castle, well, a bunch of White Castle burgers. White Castle says, the captain says, White Castle has been putting holes in their patties since 1954. In 1954, White Castle employee named Earl Howell, who worked at the company's Cincinnati location, suggested that the now iconic patties would cook faster if they were punctured with a series of little holes. Well, obviously, that cooking model was incorporated into their business model. And let's see, I just found a... Subway sandwiches, which they make submarines, you know, the long, so 12-inch, you know, whatever, foot-long sandwiches. Subway serves about 5,300 sandwiches every day, every 60 seconds, excuse me. Subway makes about 5,300 sandwiches every 60 seconds, which is roughly 320,000 sandwiches per hour, or 7,600,000 subs per day. And, of course, now what the interesting thing about Subway is, is if, well, I'll tell you what I like. For me, I like their Italian BMT. Has, what do you call it? Well, you got the bun, the sub roll, and they give you a variety of sub rolls that you can pick. They have, I like mayo on mine, onion, black olives, onion, bell pepper, jalapeno pepper, and banana pepper, oil, salt, pepper, and oregano. I guess those are the component parts. And then, well, those are component parts. I always have them slice it up in four sections. But those are component parts. Because at Subway, you know, everybody's at different order can be different or whatever. But so anyway, and, you know, it doesn't take them that long to make that sandwich. So, like I say, we want to start next Monday, if not Sunday evening, but definitely Monday morning. We're going to break down the component parts, 15 to 20 minutes. Now, we can spend more time than that, but bare minimum time spent on the daily is 15 to 20 minutes on the component parts of what we're building, and then building it daily, and then as we go, we're going to see out which ways can we improve. I believe that, you know, like I say, it's, I mean, look how many churches that are out there where pastor might be able to recommend, and well, you know, there's this shelter and that shelter, and with even with the, you know, pastor Slade out there, but they were only able to house six people. So, but they even moved quicker now than what they did when they started. So, anyway, the White Castle methodology applied towards tiny homes. That's, I can see that. Reba, any if you're still there, any thoughts to close out today?
I am inspired by reaching out to the shelters, you know. But I do consider maybe the shelter organizers, hopefully they would be super supportive, you know, reaching out to their clients, because I would say to get funding, you know, the success rate of your clients meeting their goals is ultimate. So we could actually, that's actually a grant area to be able to, a workshop with shelters. Yeah, so that's awesome.
Yes.
And Eli says he enjoys the show.
Faith-based organizations, you can go to areas where there's a high eviction rate or a high foreclosure rate. And, you know, this is, you know, if things don't work out with the landlord or whatever, then here, which they can actually learn a skill and become a part of a community where they'll never have to face that kind of problem ever again. Chris, any closing comments for today or this week?
Yes. Before the end of the week here, we all wanted to let you know, I'm going to make an announcement today. We have started an ILF, an independent living facility, in a three-bedroom apartment here in Bloomington, Illinois. And by the end of June, it will have at least six occupants inside of it. They will come off the street, moving their life forward. And I wanted to mention that. I'm working with the social workers here in town to fill all the beds. But one of them is going to be one of the young men that I've been working with for the past year. And, yeah, I wanted to say that. So we have one independent living facility. We can do this anywhere in the country. We just need rental property. We would like four bedrooms or above. Right now, we do have thousands of young adults that they're actually children that need to relocate, that are aging out of the foster system. And this is one way to give them support and continue to have something they've never really had. So you don't have to be a kid, be an adult, be a woman. It can be a combination of a family situation. But we need to, you know, see about what you have, where you are, and reach out. You know, my phone number is 309-542-6319. Website is hopeforhousing.org and dreamhabitat.org. You know, we need people to reach out and get involved here. Just tell us what you got. Show us what you got. If you already have something, let's rent it. Let's get people in it. You know, let's turn it into revenue. We can guarantee the funding to be there every month. But right now, you know, I'm gonna make a stand with the little three bedroom that I found. It's a beautiful apartment. And people are going to go from a box to success, and that's what I want to see. Not living in a stairwell, but having one.
Right, right. Okay, well, all right, I'm motivated. Let's call it for now right now, White Castle Housing. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.